But Yarrow, one of the best men to emigrate to Texas during these turbulent years, had seen enough of it. The good men, like Austin, lacked courage, and the bad ones, like the fugitive murderers and embezzlers at San Felipe, lacked judgment. He could see no hope for the colony, but he did foresee a kind of permanent tension between Mexico and the United States. He concluded that the best chance for a man of inventiveness and daring lay in California. So, on a bright morning in January, he bade the residents at Quimper's farewell, shouldered his two packs, and headed west. That afternoon, when all were still lamenting his absence, Yancey Quimper shouted from the porch where he was resting, "Mom, here he is!" And the McNabs assumed it was Yarrow, changing his mind. Instead, it was a bent old man, Father Clooney, now 67, but looking much older because of his stay in the Mexican prison. "Good God," Mattie cried as she ran to him. "What did they do to you?" He was limping so badly that he had to be helped by two young priests, who explained. The new governor pardoned him. He was supposed to find refuge in Zacatecas with the Franciscans, but he insisted on coming back to his old parish, and here he is. "Will you stay with him?" Mattie asked, as she helped him onto the porch. "No, we've been assigned to Nacogdoches, and in the morning we move on." The three clerics slept that night on the porch. Mattie offered Father Clooney a bed, but he said, "I'll stay with me, lads, this last night." And in the morning he blessed them as they started for the remotest outpost of the Mexican Empire. "You'll like it up there, lads. Good people and souls to be saved." As they departed, he stood with Mattie, watching as Finlay McNabb poled the ferry across the Brazos. "How wonderful it must be for them, Mattie, to be young, facing a new world, and knowing there's chapels to be built and pagans to be saved." He was not at the inn 3 days, painful days of recuperation from his travail, before couples started arriving to have their informal marriages solemnized. And now Reverend Harrison felt it obligatory to withdraw. "No need," Father Clooney said. "I'm sure they'd appreciate your blessing, too." But Harrison was worried more for the old man than for himself. "You speak kindly to a Methodist, and the Mexicans'll throw you back in jail." "I think they'll let me run my course," Clooney said, as he wearily prepared for the weddings. He was a tired old man now, worn out by the race of life. He had seen enough of frontier living, especially the hideous wars with Indians when each side tried to demonstrate its superior claim to savagery, and the petty rebellions, with 15 Mexicans dead and 16 Americans, to know that man was a frail creature who lived on this earth but briefly and rarely well. A good horse, a reliable woman, sons to protect the old age, and enough to eat. That was the best man could hope for. And if perchance he heard far echoes of God and Jesus, never seen but surely there, so much the better. "Life," he told Mattie one evening, "is a whole lot better if you have reassurances." He liked a good steak, cooked over embers, and he was especially fond of white bread smeared with butter. But flour was so rare in Texas that he had sometimes gone for a whole year without tasting bread. A hunk of meat, two Mexican flapjacks made of corn, and now and then a beer. "That's my penance for having left those fine cooks in Ireland." Having lived in 4 different lands, Ireland, England, and Louisiana, briefly, and Mexico, it was his measured judgment that Texas cooking was the worst in the world. "But I eat enough of it to keep me belly fat, and I do believe that when I die, the table set in heaven will be a mite bit better." He rose at dawn on the wedding day to take breakfast with Mattie, who asked him, "Should I marry Reverend Harrison?" And he advised her, "If ever a woman sees a reasonably good man, take him." She then asked if he considered Harrison a good man, and he said, "He's a man of God, but also a man of revolution. Does one destroy the other? I don't know." She asked if he thought the revolution which Harrison preached would materialize, and he said, "A year of jail knocks desire for revolution out of a man." Then suddenly he dropped his weary head on the table, and for a moment she thought he was weeping. But when he lifted his face, he was smiling. "I'm so ashamed, Mattie. I'm covered with disgrace." "Why?" "Jail is forgivable when you go there for the reasons you did." "Oh, jail has nothing to do with it. But recently I've caught myself thinking, I hope it all hangs together for the rest of my life. Then to hell with it." What a shameful surrender. He studied her across the rough wooden breakfast table, then confessed, "Harrison is the voice of the future. I'm the past." Now tears did come to his eyes, and he did not try to hide them. "In Ireland, I wrecked me parish. Here, I converted never an Indian. In Mexico, I wound up in jail. And the years have fled so swiftly." Mattie rose and went about her duties, leaving him there. And after a while he went on to the porch, where he supervised the placement of the rude altar from which he would preach to the seven couples. When this was completed, he returned to the doorway, looked in at Mattie, and said, his face beaming with love for the old days, "Matt, old girl, I do wish your husband and the Kronk were here this day. I miss them." Marriage to Father Clooney remained the most sacred of rites, but when the ceremony was over, he did enjoy a bit of celebration, and was especially appreciative if it involved some warming spirits. That evening, the dancing, the fiddle playing, and the shouting were lively, but next morning Clooney was up early, showing no signs of excessive wear. "Now, who are the ones who seek conversion in order to grab a wee bit of land?" he asked as the day began. And when four families, including McNab and his son, were lined up on the porch, he proceeded mechanically to make them technical Catholics. But if he took such political conversion lightly, Finlay could not, for when he stood next in line and realized that he must soon take a solemn oath abjuring John Knox's religion, for which his Highland ancestors had died rather than surrender it to the Pope, his knees began to shake, his throat rent dry, and a crazed look came into his eye. He recalled those great battles in Northern Ireland between the Presbyterians and the Papists, the centuries of struggle of which he had been a part, and he found himself powerless to move forward. Father Clooney had seen these symptoms before, always in people who had come to Texas via Northern Ireland, and in his compassion, he made it easy for Finlay and Otto to step aside. That day, the McNabs were not converted. The shock was simply too great. But that night, Clooney talked with both father and son, for he insisted that Otto be present. "I know well the torment you feel. I've seen it before, and I respect you for your integrity. I can tell you only two things. My religion is one of the sweetest, gentlest in the world, a consolation and a redemption. I've loved it for nearly 70 years, and when I die within its embrace I shall know no fear, for God has been with me always. The Mexican government, in its wisdom, has said that you cannot have land unless you convert to the religion it sponsors. This is a clear law, not unreasonable and not unfairly administered. So if you want land, you McNabs, you must convert this day, for tomorrow I may be gone. Let me tell you this, my sons. To own land is a good thing, and if you find it in your hearts to join my church, you may discover, like many before you, that it's a worthy home, one which assures you much benevolence." The old man did not go on to finish his statement, the implied part about what would happen if the McNabs did not find their new religion congenial. and he certainly did not say that, so far as he was concerned, once they got their land, they were free to revert to Presbyterianism. But his entire manner implied that such was his belief. So Finlay and Otto became Catholics, trembling with fear lest they be struck dead for the blasphemy they were committing. But Father Clooney blessed them just the same, and smiled at the heavy perspiration on Finlay's forehead. That night, Father Clooney slept on the porch as usual, but he was uneasy. And long after midnight he roused Finlay and sat with him by the flickering fire. "My son, we must do something about getting you land." "I've converted." "That may not be enough. Authorities have grown suspicious of Austin. They're inspecting every grant he makes." "What should I do?" "Forget Austin. Go back to Victoria and ask the De Leons for an assignment in their grant." "Will they give it?" "I know that family well, one of the best. I'll write them a letter recommending you." "I'd appreciate that. I'll get it in the morning." To McNab's surprise, Father Clooney reached and grasped his hand as if he were responsible for his new convert's welfare. "No, we'd better do it now." And taking paper from the same old Bible with which he had converted the Quimpers years before, he drafted a warm note to the De Leons, beseeching them to award land to his trusted friend McNab. Handing Finlay the paper, he returned unsteadily to the porch. Sometime after dawn, as was her custom, Mattie went to him with a cup of broth. But when she tried to waken him, he did not respond. For several terrifying moments, she kept prodding him with her foot, refusing to believe that he was dead. Then his left arm fell lifeless onto the boards of the porch, and she could no longer ignore the evidence. She did not cry out, nor did she call for help. She merely looked down at the body of a man she had first suspected, then grown to love. A faithful shepherd whose flock had been so widely scattered that he had worn himself out tending it. As if his death had also terminated a portion of her life, she gave no further thought to the proposed marriage with Reverend Harrison. After the funeral, which the Methodist conducted with a glowing tribute to his one-time adversary, she sent him north, where he married a much younger widow, who helped him fan the fires of rebellion. Otto observed this tangled behavior of his elders, Isaac Yarrow's bitter dismissal of Texas, Reverend Harrison's erratic courtship, the willful return of Father Clooney to a parish in turmoil, the curious behavior of Yancey, 10 years older than himself and therefore an adult in his eyes, and the almost inhuman drive of Mattie, without understanding many of the actions or any of their motivations. But as the McNabs were preparing to quit the inn and move south with a letter to the De Leons in Victoria, an event occurred which he comprehended perfectly. From the opposite side of the Brazos, at 11 one bright morning, a loud halloo came ringing through the air, and Otto ran to see what traveler was coming south. To his delight, it was Benito Garza, the muleteer he had known in New Orleans. So without alerting Mattie, he dashed to the beach ferry, jumped in, and started poling across the river, shouting as he did, "Benito, it's me, Otto McNab." And as he neared the far shore, Garza, standing with his two helpers, recognized the boy and shouted back, "The little horseman, hooray!" And the two assistants added their olays. The three traders piled into the ferry, and Otto proudly escorted them across the river and up to the inn, where he called loudly, "Mattie, strangers!" But when she came to the porch, she deflated the boy. "Garza, we've been friends for years." It was a lively reunion, but also an emotional one, for after the noise and the embraces, Garza almost shyly handed Mattie a present, and when she opened it to the applause of all, she found a bolt of English cloth and a simple dress made in France. They were the first such gifts she had ever received, and for a long time she was silent. Then she said in a flat tone, "You carried them a long way, Benito." Now everyone spoke at once, and Garza learned of Yarrow's exile, Father Clooney's death, and the McNabs' conversion. He wanted to know where Zave Campbell had located his land, and Finley explained, "He hasn't exactly chosen it yet, but he favors a stretch along the Guadalupe." And Garza approved. Any land washed by a river is good. It was Otto who spoke the words that mattered. "Fact is, he's not looking for land, he's looking for a wife." As Otto was talking, Benito was holding Mattie's French dress against her spare form. But the boy's words so startled him that he dropped the dress, left Mattie, and took Otto by the arm. "What did you say?" "He's not really looking for his land. The other part, is he looking for a wife?" "Yes, he gets 4 times as much land if he finds one." It was then that Benito Garza's maneuvering began. Sitting at the rough table and addressing all those in the kitchen, including 2 travelers who were eating, he said, "We were 9 children, and the family had only 1 ranch along the Rio Grande. No chance for me to inherit the land, so I brought my 2 youngest sisters with me to Victoria. I'm head of the family. With some difficulty, I found the oldest one, Maria, a husband, José Mardones, but he didn't last long." "Did he run away?" Mattie asked. And he replied, "No, he was shot, stealing horses from a Norte Americano." Otto interrupted, "You told me in New Orleans that horses ran free." "Trained horses are different," Garza said. Then he addressed Finley. "So this wonderful woman, only 31, still has no husband. And if Senor Campbell—" "How about your younger sister?" Mattie asked. And he replied, "Josefina? She's only 26. She can wait. Always get your oldest sister married first." This perplexed Otto. "But if they're older than you, why don't they find their own husbands?" And Garza replied with dignity, "In a Mexican family, it's the father's obligation, and I am their father, so to speak." Now Garza became zealous for an immediate return to Victoria. "We've got to reach Campbell before he makes a serious mistake." So before the McNabs were really ready to depart, Garza applied constant pressure for them to hurry. "Everything is better for a Norte Americano in Texas if he has a reliable Mexican wife. Suppose he wants land. Suppose he gets into trouble with the alcalde, or if the priests act up. He may already have found a wife." "I hope not. He would be throwing himself away if he didn't take Maria. I promise you, Senor McNab, this woman is exceptional. A man finds a wife like her once in 100 years. In the morning, the McNabs looked in surprise as Garza bent low over Mattie's hands, kissing each in turn. And even Otto could see that the Mexican herdsman loved this rough woman who ran the ferry. And they treated him with more respect as they moved south toward Victoria. There, Garza hurried ahead, shouting as he entered the town, "Senor Campbell!" He located the big quintuck some distance to the north, tenting under a big oak on the banks of the Guadalupe, and his greeting was fervid. "What fine land you've chosen! Have you found a wife?" When Zave said no, Garza gave an immense sigh, slumped to the earth beside Campbell, and said softly, "Senor, I liked you from the minute I saw you in New Orleans. I could see then that you had character. Now let us all go back to Victoria so that Senor Finley can present the papers given him by Father Clooney and claim his land." He did not mention his sisters. The De Leons accepted the recommendation of the revered priest, and after lamenting his death, they said, "We welcome you to Victoria. Choose your land wisely." And it was then that Garza said almost casually, "Since we are all here, why don't we go see my sisters?" But he could not help adding, "Señor Campbell, I give you my word, you're going to like Maria." He led the way to a 2-room adobe shack he had built near the central plaza, and as he approached it, he started shouting, "Maria, I bring new friends." And to the rough wooden doorway came an ample woman with a big, warm face. When her dark eyes looked at the newcomers and her mouth broke into a smile of welcome, Otto knew immediately that he had found a replacement for his Baltimore mother. And as the days passed in her benign presence, this feeling deepened. For Maria Garza Mardones was one of those women who embraced the world. Her laugh sounded like a deep-throated bell. She was patient with the follies of men, and she adored children, chickens, colts, and hard work. The closing weeks of 1831 were memorable because the Americans and the Garzas moved out to Campbell's land and started building a dog run. The three men chopped trees for the timbers, while the two Garza women and Otto mixed mud and straw to make adobes. Since each person worked as if the resulting cabin was to be his or her own, the floor plan could be spacious, with the open runway full 18 feet wide, and each of the two halves larger than the ones at Quimper's Ferry. At the end of the first week, the McNabs were surprised to see that Campbell was driving stakes to outline a 3rd room on the north. "What's that for?" Finlay asked. And Zave said, "You and Otto, till you get your own land and your own house." Otto, who had fallen in love with Maria, considered this an admirable decision, for he expected his friend Zave to marry the Mexican woman. And he was further pleased on Wednesday of the 2nd week, when Zave started driving even more stakes for a 4th room, also on the north, but well separated from the one intended for the McNabs. "What's that one for?" Otto asked. And Zave said, "Benito and his sister Josefina, they're to be living with us too." "Are you marrying Maria?" Otto asked. And when Zave answered, "Yep, I can't pass over a woman who can really work," the boy rushed to the stalwart Mexican woman and began kissing her. So before the 1st room of the dog run was even well started, Zave had planned what amounted to a frontier mansion, and that was the beginning of the good times at Zave Campbell's. What gave this particular house a touch of extra charm was its position near a solitary live oak festooned with Spanish moss, which meant that the tree provided both decoration and some protection against the sun. Also, a traditional long, low porch joined the two halves on the south side, but in this instance it also swung around to enclose the western end. At close of day, the occupants could rest there and watch the sun go down. Maria, once her marriage to Campbell was solemnized, showed great affection for Otto, and since she had reason to believe that she could have no children of her own, and the boy was so appreciative of anything she did for him, she considered him her son. And for his part, he adopted Mexican ways, learning not only the language, but also the handling of cattle. Under Benito's skilled tutelage, he improved the shooting skills Zave Campbell had taught him on the trace. But it was in horseback riding that he appreciated Benito most, for Garza was both patient and firm in teaching him the basics. And soon he had Otto galloping at the head of the file when the Mexican hands rode forth to round up mustangs. With Benito's help, he broke one for himself, a high-spirited little beast with a tawny coat and an obstinate spirit. "What shall I call him?" he asked Benito. And that excellent horseman said, "Chico. He'll learn he's Chico real fast." For a boy of 10, there was a beautiful world to be explored. It was spring, and the fields along the Guadalupe were studded with fascinating trees, the wild persimmon, the thorn huizache, the delicate pecans. There were the taller trees, too, that he had missed in those desolate flats by the sea, the post oaks, the cottonwoods, the ash, and always that persistent half-tree, half-shrub which fascinated him with its gnarled branches and sharp thorns, the mesquite. Sometimes, as he wandered among his trees, he would come upon a wild boar tusking the earth, or fawns grazing, or the silent slither of a copperhead, the noisy warning of a rattler. Each evening, when he returned home, he found that Maria had prepared some new treat, for she was a most ingenious woman, capable of transforming the poorest materials into something delicious. And he grew to love the tortillas she made so patiently, kneeling before the stone metate as she beat the boiled corn into the gray-white mixture she later baked on the flat rocks. But he liked especially the peasant dish she made with whatever bits of meat her lodgers might provide. Bear, buffalo, venison, possum, goat, beef, all were alike to her. Collecting a few onions from her garden and red chili peppers that grew wild, she followed an unbroken ritual, which she explained to Otto in her flowing Spanish. You must have two pans. Brown the meat in this one so it looks good. In this one, put a lot of bear grease, the chopped chilies, the onions, and a bit of garlic if you can find it. She was generous in the amount of grease she used, because she wanted the final dish to be golden brown in color and with lots of nourishment for her hard-working men. When the two pans were properly heated on the coals and a rich smell was pervading the kitchen, she took from a treasured hoard imported from Monterrey or Saltillo small samples of two valuable spices, oregano and comino, and after measuring up the proper portions in a pot, she mixed in all the other ingredients with a flourish, stirred well, then placed the pot back on the coals. She would never allow any beans to be added to her dish. No true Mexican puts beans in chili. The result, after hours of careful cooking, was a rich, spicy, aromatic meat dish, whose principal flavor was a marvelous mix of red-hot chili and oregano. But she never served it alone. In the evening, before she made this chili con carne, she threw into a pot a large helping of beans, any kind available, and these she soaked overnight. She refused ever to cook a bean until it had been soaked. I think God would strike me dead if I just threw beans in cold water and cooked them, she told Otto. They must be soaked. She also insisted upon sieving them three times through her fingers. To sort out the little rocks. Many a person has lost a tooth biting into rocks, but not in my beans. She rose early in the morning, simmered her soaked beans for 2 hours, then boiled them for two more. When they were well done, she mashed them, added a little oil and fried onions, then fried them lightly in a pan. Now they're ready to eat with chili, she told Otto. But she was most careful to see that the two dishes never mixed. Each was to be respected for its own uniqueness. With such food and affection, Otto had never been happier. But one aspect of his life along the Guadalupe did cause him worry. He was a true McNab, descendant of a clan that had stolen cattle for hundreds of years, and he had seen how his father and his dear friend Zave had gathered strays during their trip along the Natchez Trace. But his developing sense of right and wrong had warned him that such behavior was criminal, and he was pleased when his father dropped the habit. Now he watched as Campbell instructed Benito in the tricks of bringing into his care any cattle or horses that did not have a specific home, and some that did. Otto went to his father, pointing out that in Texas men burned marks on the flanks of their animals to prove ownership, and he had seen in Zave's fields animals with several different brands. Finley dismissed his fears. All Campbells are like that. Worry of a more subtle kind was caused by Benito, now 26. For slowly, the boy of 10 was beginning to realize that his Mexican friend had a violent and often vicious temper. Benito would pummel any Mexican workman who displeased him. Often Otto saw that he wanted to punch Zave, too, but was afraid. Then his neck muscles would tremble, and he would turn away and spit. In training mustangs, he was needlessly cruel, and when Otto protested, he laughed. Horses and women need to be beaten, then they become the best. Otto, who had cringed when drunken men had thrashed their easy under-the-hill women, asked if Maria's Mexican husband had ever beaten her, and Benito snapped, "Plenty, and she deserved it." Statements like that bewildered the boy, for he had witnessed Benito's ardor in furthering his sister's interests, and he remembered his thoughtfulness in bringing Mattie Quimper those presents. "Sometimes I don't understand him. It's like he has a dark side." Maria had other concerns, for when she was satisfied that her home in the dog run was secure and that her Norteamericano husband was a good man, she began her campaign to find equal stability for her sister Josefina. Whenever the men complimented her cooking, she told them, "Josefina did it," even though Otto knew she hadn't. Any fine sewing was done by Josefina, and occasionally Maria would say to Finley, "This one, she's a good girl, believe me." When Josefina smiled, Maria would ask, "See that lovely crooked smile she has? It came from our mother, Trinidad de Saldana, a refined lady from San Antonio." Despite this constant advocacy, McNabb showed no interest, until one noon, when the stew was extra good, thanks to Josefina, Maria said in Spanish. "Don Finlay, did it ever occur to you that if you married Josefina, you could get a whole league and a labor next 2 hours?" McNabb said nothing, but he did sit straighter. "And when Javier and I die," she pronounced the name Javier, "who would get our land but Otto?" Now McNabb was all attention. "Don Finlay, can you imagine your son coming into possession of 2 leagues and more?" On this day, Finley made no response, but often during the next month, while Maria continued to stress her sister's abilities, he thought of the good land along the river which Josefina, as his wife, would enable him to claim, and she became increasingly attractive. One afternoon, he rode into Victoria to talk with Martin de Leon, who held rights to this huge tract of land, an entitlement from the government in Mexico City in 1824. And without identifying Josefina, he asked whether a converted Catholic would also be ceded a league and a labor if he married a Mexican woman. "Of a certainty," De Leon assured him in Spanish. Then De Leon said in good English, "But it would be good if you would caution your friend Xavier about fooling with other people's horses. Tempers can grow very short in Texas." Finley did speak to Campbell, but not about cattle rustling. He asked, "Zave, what would you think if I married Josefina and claimed on the league next to yours?" The big man rocked back and forth for some time, staring at the prairie, which could be seen from his porch. "Your wife dead?" "Divorced." "Legal?" "Yep." "Marry her. Land is land." But later, when McNabb was off tending cattle, Zave asked Otto, "What happened to your mother in Baltimore?" And the boy replied in some confusion, for his memory of his mother was clouded. "Things happened, and we left." "Was there a judge?" Zave asked. "There was a lot of yelling," the boy replied, and Zave said, "I bet there was." The big man never mentioned the matter again, but when Finley suggested going back to Quimper's Ferry for the wedding, Zave said, "More better we use the priest from the mission at Goliad." "Why?" "I hear the new priest serving Quimper's is very strict. Lots of questions, maybe even letters to Baltimore." "You mean the priest at Goliad? He'd be less rigorous?" "He's always in a hurry. Better we use him." And Zave was so insistent that, in the end, he and Maria, Finlay and Josefina, Benito and Otto, rode their horses over to Goliad, where the ceremony was performed. When the priest asked in Spanish whether any man had reasons to oppose this marriage or knew of any impediment to forbid it, both Zave and Otto looked straight ahead. As soon as the newly married couple returned home, Finlay hurried into Victoria and laid claim to his league and a labor. He received it promptly, with 160 acres as a bonus for his son. With full encouragement from Maria and Zave, the McNabs delayed building their own house. They stayed on with the Campbells, adding an improvised room to match Benito's, thus increasing the value of their holdings. Under Benito's tutelage, Zave was becoming an expert in breeding mules and herding wild longhorn cattle. Maria and Josefina made some of the best food in the area. Otto helped everyone, and Finlay specialized in marketing the various goods they were producing. They also offered the dog run to the transient public as a kind of inn, $1 a night, $4 by the week. Guests slept in a third lean-to which Zave and Benito built, and the rambling affair became one of the better stopping places in that part of Texas, with respectable meals provided by the wives, plus occasional treats that Finlay acquired through sharp trading with ships putting into Matagorda, or from caravans of merchants hauling their goods overland from Mexican cities south of the Rio Grande. The informal inn had both a good reputation and a bad one. Travelers said, "No better hospitality than what these women provide at Campbell's. But Zave is exceptionally sharp. Got to keep your eye on him." Travelers as far away as Nacogdoches and Béjar said this of the posada west of Victoria. It was Finlay who made the proposal that, since mules and cattle were prospering at the plantation, as it was called by travelers from Georgia and Alabama, why did not he and Otto, enlisting Benito as their guide and two of his relatives as helpers, take a herd to New Orleans, where Louis Ferry had promised to buy them at a good price? Victoria to the Sabine may be 250 miles. Sabine to New Orleans, about the same, estimated a man who had traveled it. Whereupon Finlay said, "We drove cattle lots farther than that on the Trace." But Zave corrected him. "Trace is 480. I walked every step, 3 round trips." When it was agreed that such a drive was practical, Finlay hurried down to Matagorda Bay and posted an inquiry to Mr. Ferry, and in a surprisingly short time, less than 4 weeks, had an answer. "Bring all the mules and longhorns you can manage, also some good horses. Market even better than when you were here a year ago. Louis Ferry." With this encouragement, McNabb assembled a herd of 40 longhorns, 31 mules, and 24 mustangs broken to the saddle, and with a double supply of horses for himself and his helpers, he set forth. And quickly he found himself on the famous Beef Trail. Since those early days when Benito Garza had pioneered a trail to New Orleans for his mules, so many Texas drovers had followed in his steps that a well-defined path had taken shape. The Beef Trail flourished half a century earlier than the better-known trails like the Chisholm, which cattle followed on their way to the Kansas railheads, and in its day it provided Texas frontiersmen with a chance to earn hard cash. Otto had been on the trail only a few days when he realized that his journey down the Natchez Trace had been, in comparison, merely a pleasant excursion. For one thing, the Texas rivers were infinitely more difficult to cross, because their banks could be steep and their currents swift after a rain. Food was scarcer and more poorly prepared, if that was possible, and above all, there was the constant threat that Indians might hear of the movement of so many horses and try to steal their share on the first moonlit night. Finally, the roads and trails in Texas were not yet as clearly marked as the Natchez Trace, which had been used by white men for a long time when the McNabs traversed it. But without question, the Beef Trail, rugged though it was, offered more delights to young Otto than anything in Kentucky or Tennessee. This was true wilderness, with birds and animals he had never seen before, with bayous lined by moss-covered trees, with a daring Mexican rider like Benito to search out the trail, and with always the sense of a new country to be explored in whatever direction one might care to go. Also, as Otto confided to his father at the end of a long day, it's a lot more fun to ride than to walk. Already skilled as a horseman, he now acquired from Benito those extra tricks that would make him a true expert. But Garza was powerless to make him proficient with the lariat. "Damn it, I know you're not stupid," he would shout in Spanish. "You can ride, you can shoot, surely you can learn to throw a rope." But Otto could not. His hands were small and his arms short, and when he tried to twirl the stiff and heavy rope about his head in great circles, he not only got it tangled, but he nearly succeeded in strangling himself. "Damn it, Otto, no. You're supposed to throw it over the Mustang's neck, not your own." It was hopeless. Despite his sweating determination, the young Scots-Irish-German-American boy could not do what the Mexicans did so effortlessly. And sometimes he would sit astride some huge horse, watching in awe as the three men competed in roping. They were superb. But if they wanted to race with Otto, they found him now able to ride as effectively as they, swaying with the horse or leaning far over the neck of his Mustang until he became one with his steed, flying over the empty land. And if the four dismounted and took their guns to hunt for food, or merely to compete at targets, young Otto proved superior. He was a superb marksman, cool, hard-eyed, even of hand and steady of wrist. "Eres un verdadero Tejano," Benito said approvingly one day. But then he added, "Of course, if you want to rope cattle, you must hire a real Mexicano." One evening, as he and Benito rode in, tired and dusty from chasing one of the few buffalo left in those parts, Otto washed down his horse, but then stayed with it, saying to himself, "I'll never forget this day. I'll never have a friend better than Benito, nor a mother better than Maria, nor a dog better than Betsy. Where's Baltimore? It seems so far away. I'm half Texican, half Mexican." Driven by a sense of wild joy, he leaped back onto his horse and galloped across the countryside. He was an Indian chasing buffalo, a Tennessean shooting a deer, a Mexican about to rope a longhorn. When he returned to camp, he saw Garza and realized how much he owed him. Riding up to the Mexican, he dismounted, grasped his hand, and said, "You are my friend." Few lads of Otto's age would understand Texas as thoroughly as he. By the time they crossed the Sabine River into Louisiana, he had been pretty well across the face of settled Texas, save for the Nacogdoches quarter. He knew most of the ferries where boats could be relied upon, most of the river crossings that could be negotiated on foot. He had stopped in most of the semi-formal inns, and his knowledge of horses, cattle, and the Spanish language would make him an invaluable ranch hand or owner when he had acquired enough money to start for himself. New Orleans had a magical effect on Finley McNabb, for the excitement of selling his animals, the bantering of the buyers, and the good fellowship of the stockyards reminded him of those faraway days at the Falkirk Tryst when he discovered the kind of person he was, and he hoped that here his son might have the same kind of awakening. "When I wasn't much older than you, I drove my grandfather's cattle to a great fair and sold them too. That was the beginning of my real life. This could be the same for you. Study New Orleans. Learn how men do things." Otto's instruction took a rewarding turn when Mr. Ferry, pleased by the good condition of their cattle and mules, came by their hotel to invite them to dinner at one of the fine French eating places. As an afterthought, he tossed a handful of coins toward the three Mexicans. "Get yourself something." Otto did not linger to see the bitterness with which Benito scorned the coins, letting them fall to the floor, or the furious manner in which he forbade his helpers to pick them up. "Let the maids have them," he stormed. When Otto saw the luxurious dining room with its high ceilings and glittering lights, he said enthusiastically, "This must be awful expensive." And Fairy laughed. "On the profit I'll make from your animals, I can afford it. I ship your mules to Uncle Sam's army, and sell your beef to the riverboats and restaurants like this. Young man, tonight you'll feast upon one of your own longhorns." Otto was old enough to relish good food, and hungry enough after the frontier fare of Texas to appreciate a varied menu. In fact, he considered New Orleans to be about 6 levels better than Cincinnati, and said so, to Mr. Ferry's approval. But as he gorged on the excellent food, he could not help picturing Benito Garza eating in some grubby hole, and he winced as he recalled the niggardly manner in which Mr. Ferry had thrown the coins. 2 days later, while walking the streets, Otto came upon an auction house where consignments of slaves from Virginia and the Carolinas were being sold, and he followed the action with great interest, trying to guess which of 2 or 3 competing bidders would stay the course and win this lot or that. When he heard that one would-be purchaser intended taking his slaves, if he succeeded in buying any, to Texas, he approached the man and warned him, "You know, mister, that slaves are not allowed in Texas." This news so startled both the buyer and the men near him that a vigorous discussion occurred, marked by a ridiculous lack of expert opinion, until in the end Otto had to inform the men of the situation. They refused to believe such a mere boy, but an elderly man, well versed on the question, came to Otto's defense, and stated firmly that Mexican law forbade slavery and the importation of slaves. "Then by God we'll change the law," one hothead shouted, and this brought cheers. "In 5 years, Texas will be American." More cheers. "I'll march to Texas, and so will 100 brave lads like me," another cried. But when this display ended, the would-be purchaser still did not know how to proceed. And Otto quietly explained 99-year indentures, and the man was delighted. What a thoroughly sensible solution! And forthwith he bid high on 6 different lots. Mr. Ferry introduced McNabb to the convenience of letters of credit and suggested that he might like to avail himself of one. But Finley, having been burned by the skilled salesman of the Texas Land and Improvement Company, did not propose to be hornswoggled again, and said so. Ferry laughed at his fears, but at the same time recognized his prudence. "Goodness, I don't mean a letter of credit on me. I might skedaddle at any moment. No, I mean a letter on the firmest bank in the South." And he took Finley to the offices of the famous Louisiana and Southern States Banking House, where the manager said he would be honored to accommodate any client of Mr. Ferry's. On the spur of the moment, Finley did a most uncharacteristic thing. He was so encouraged by the success of his droving operation, and so titillated at sitting in the offices of a major bank, with every prospect of sitting there more often in the future, that he decided it would be only decent to share his good fortune with his daughters back in Baltimore, and he asked the New Orleans banker if he could convey half his funds to a bank in Baltimore for the account of the Mrs. McNabb. "Easiest thing in the world, Mr. McNabb. It can be done at once." So it was arranged, and McNabb felt pleased with himself because of his generosity. He then asked how his and Zabe's funds could best be handled. "I'd rather not carry them on my person, seeing that pickpockets infest the steamers." "Easiest thing in the world," the banker repeated. "Leave your money on deposit with us, earn a tidy interest, and when either you or Campbell requires a load of timber for building a new house, inform me by shipmail, and your good friend Mr. Ferry will have it on board the next vessel to Galveston Bay." It won't do us much good at Galveston, seeing as we live near Matagorda. The banker chuckled and said that one of these days he must get down to Texas, for he was convinced it was bound to be a major trading center of the American Union. It's owned by Mexico, you know, McNabb said. And wherever Findlay moved in New Orleans, he found this same attitude toward Texas, as if the Louisiana men sensed that their western neighbor must soon become a part of the United States. The closing days of their visit were marred by the discovery that Benito Garza and his two relatives had quit the expedition. For 3 days the McNabs tried to find them, learning only that Benito, cursing Ferry, had summoned his two cousins and ridden back to Texas. There was much castigation of the Mexicans, but when the McNabs were alone, Otto said, "Remember when Mr. Ferry threw the money at them, as if they weren't good enough to eat with us? I don't blame Benito for getting mad." When the McNabs returned to Victoria, Findlay sought out Benito and said, "I'm sorry for the way Mr. Ferry treated you." And Garza snarled, "Gringos, what can you expect?" Since most of the McNab horses had been taken to New Orleans, Zabe had replaced them. But Otto noticed that several bore strange brands. And later, two of De Leon's men took the boy aside and warned him. "Your friend, Senor Campbell, he better watch out. The Anglos in this area are fed up with his thieving ways, and something bad will happen to him if he does not mend them." When Otto, refusing to hear ill of his friend, protested that maybe it was Benito Garza who took horses with other brands, the men said, "We're watching him, too." Otto felt it necessary to warn his father, and Findlay took it seriously. But when he confronted Zave, the big Kaintuck turned the tables by upbraiding him for not having brought home Zave's share of the profits. "Somehow you made a deal with Ferry that does you good, but not me." When McNabb tried to explain what a deposit in a bank meant and how it drew interest, the stubborn redhead could not follow and loudly accused his friend of chicanery. This so irritated McNabb, who understood the facts but could not explain them over Zave's shouting, that in anger he informed Campbell that he and Otto would build their own house. "Good riddance," Zave yelled. But Otto cried that he would not permit this, for he had grown to love big, compassionate Maria and could not visualize life without her. Josefina was equally good, quite a wonderful mother, but Maria had come first, and he saw her as the architect of his good fortunes. When he flatly refused to part from her, the shouting stopped, and the breach was healed. Thus began a perplexity which would haunt him all his life, and haunt Texas. He loved Mexicans like Maria, and instinctively respected their values, so vastly different from his own. He saw that such Mexicans led an easy, sing-song life, in harmony with the birds and the rising sun, while Texicans, like his father, lived a tense one, in which cattle had to be counted and delivered on time. Maria followed the easy traditions of Catholicism, in which saints and the Virgin Mary were as real as the people who lived on the next hacienda. He would always be a Presbyterian, with that religion's harsh commands and unforgiving penalties. She sang, but he brooded. Even at age 11, he brooded. To her, the family was everything. To him, it had proved only a shadowy remembrance. She could forgive a fellow Mexican, like her brother Benito, his misdemeanors. Otto could forgive no one. And there his ambivalence deepened. He saw that American immigrants often conceded that Maria's way of life had commendable aspects. Certainly it was more relaxed, and in many ways gentler and more humane, as in its care for elderly members of a family. But often some relative like Benito performed an act which should not have been tolerated. Otto heard Mexican men accused of being shifty, unreliable, sycophantic when controlled by others, cruel when they were masters, so that what were deemed Maria's virtues became flaws when Benito displayed them. For example, Otto had seen Benito excuse his fellow Mexicans for the grossest misbehavior, and even encourage it if it helped them gain an advantage over some Anglo. Otto heard his own father charge, "Mexican men allow themselves to be priest-ridden. They drag their church into areas where it isn't needed. Like their unstable government, Mexican men can never settle upon one course of action and follow it for a generation. Even the slightest mishap diverts them, so revolution is always around the corner." Reluctantly, the McNabs concluded that Benito Garza specifically was not a very nice person, and they concluded that the chances for his living in harmony with the immigrating Americans were not good. Otto was not yet mature enough to understand that the incoming settlers demanded that Benito behave like an American, while he and his fellow Mexicans, occupants of Texas for a century, expected the Texicans to behave like Mexicans. It was an impasse that would never be resolved. But Otto was old enough to perceive the most fundamental contradiction of all. He, like Texas itself, needed the Mexicans and often loved them, but he did not always like them. Several months after the McNabs returned home, a much more serious problem evolved from Finley's impulsive generosity in the New Orleans bank. Because when the Baltimore bank informed Mrs. Berta McNab that a substantial sum of money had been forwarded to her daughters by their father in Texas, she interpreted this as a signal of reconciliation. She was tired of living alone, and like scores of other abandoned wives in the settled states, she convinced herself that her husband in Texas needed her. With a vigor and determination that astonished her Baltimore friends, she arranged for a sea voyage to New Orleans and a Gulf trip to Victoria. Consequently, one autumn day in 1833, a horseman rode out to the Campbell Posada when the men were away, bringing news that a lady calling herself Mrs. McNab, she's landed at Linville, and she wants us to bring her here. Very quietly, Otto closed the door so that Josefina would not hear, then asked, "What does she want?" And the messenger said, "She told me she has come to join her husband." When Otto said nothing, the man asked, with a jerk of his thumb toward the room in which Josefina was singing, "And what about that one?" Otto considered this carefully, and slowly two reactions began to form. With his real mother at hand and not in distant Baltimore, he recovered a most positive image of her. It was daybreak, and she was bringing him a bowl of hot porridge, rich with butter, cream, and sugar. She had been a kind mother, and he remembered how he had grieved when forced to leave her. But her shadowy portrait was erased by the thought of Maria, the wonderful Mexican woman whom he had adopted, and whom he loved so dearly and in a different way. Desperately, he wanted to protect her and her sister from sorrow of any kind. Accordingly, without saying a word to anyone, he took his horse and accompanied the messenger back to Victoria, where he intercepted his unwelcome mother at the general store to which she had been delivered. To his amazement, he found that his two sisters, striking blondes in their late teens, had accompanied her, and that disoriented him. But he barged ahead, and when his mother sought to embrace him, he held back. "You must go home," he said. "This is to be our home, Otto. We were wrong when we sent you and father away." "You didn't send us. We went." This brought sniffles, and she groped for her handkerchief. But Otto was not moved. "You must go back, because there's no place for you here." "You and your father need me, Otto. The girls and I have come all this way to help." "Texas is a different place," the boy said. "I know. We were warned on the boat." "You won't like Texas." His harshness now brought tears to his sisters, and when he saw these attractive girls weeping, he grew ashamed of himself. "Take them out to the farm," one of the men in the shabby store said. And when Otto asked, "How can I?" the man said, "She has to know sooner or later." Mrs. McNab asked, "Know what?" And the man replied, "Lady, you'll find out soon enough." The only wagon in Victoria was procured, and Otto, aware that disaster loomed, was determined to avoid involvement with these unwelcome relatives. Riding in front of the procession, like a page leading ladies to a castle, he refused to talk with them. And when the entourage approached the dog run, he rode ahead shouting, "Hey, Papa!" Finley and Zave were home now, and when they heard Otto crying as if for help, they hurried to the spacious porch, and there they stood when Otto delivered the three women. Uncertain as to how he should explain the situation, and confused about using the word mother, he said simply, "They're here." Berta McNab burst into tears as she ran toward her husband, and the two girls stood shyly by, as embarrassed as their brother. McNab was flabbergasted, and it was left to Campbell to extend grudging civilities. "Madam and you gals, sit down," and he brought forward three chairs, but he made no motion to invite them inside. However, Maria, hearing the commotion, came to the door, whereupon Zave said hurriedly, "My wife, Maria." There were muffled acknowledgments, with Zave whispering to his wife in Spanish, "Dios, la esposa de Finley," at which Maria, thinking only of her sister, screamed, "¿Quién es esta?" And then the morning began to fall apart, because Josefina, perplexed by the noise, hurried onto the porch, whereupon Otto ran to her, threw his arms about her, and cried, "This is my mother now."